Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is The Promise of Tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of The Promise of Tomorrow.
And welcome back to the only talk radio program with guests from all over the world. Today, we're going to hear from Boston, Southern California, Australia, and New Jersey. And, of course, we'll visit the Den of Strangers, the Fountain of Useless Information, and, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments of the Voice of Reason. And we want to get right to today's lead story. What's standing in the way of all electric cars? Okay, right now we're going to check in with John McGee. He's a researcher with Boston University and giving a presentation at the IEEE Energy Conference, the important conference that's going on in September that we talk about quite a bit on this program. Welcome to the program, John.
How are you?
Oh, it's really good to have you. Now, I understand you're presenting a paper at the conference, and it kind of intrigues me. Plug-in vehicles and the plug, a policy to address the chicken and the egg problem. Could you explain that to us just a little bit here?
Sure, no problem. So there's these vehicles coming around in the future, and they're actually starting to be released that will plug in to charge. So they'll either be completely electric or they'll be hybrid electric. And to really get the benefit of these vehicles, you need a place to charge them. Mm-hmm. But people might be hesitant to buy the vehicle if you can't charge them at any place when you go out at work or when you go to commute. So there's this problem of, do we have a place to charge them? And people aren't going to build the places to charge them until the vehicles are start being produced and purchased. So what we call the chicken and the egg problem. Which came first, the place to charge the vehicles or the vehicles themselves? And what I'm kind of proposing is that we can have some policies that will have these charging stations be developed as new developments come along, and that will solve this problem of the chicken or the egg problem and allow people to charge their vehicles and hopefully encourage the adaptation of the vehicles when they get released.
Well, of course, the Chevy Volt is on the market here real shortly now, and I guess people are going to be charging that at home. But what you're saying is that people are going to be reluctant to buy these plug-in electric vehicles unless there's a place to charge them abroad. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's a little bit more complicated. So
I hear you have a dog there. What's your dog's name?
Yes, that's Cody. She's excited about electric vehicles also.
Oh, I see. All right, so what were you saying?
So it's a little bit more complicated. The great thing about the Chevy Volt is that it will have the extended range with the gasoline backup, so you don't actually have to worry about what they call range anxiety, the worry of being stuck somewhere without a charge.
Oh,
with
yeah,
that vehicle.
Yeah, sure.
There are some other vehicles that are pure electric, where you will have to charge them. And like you said, most people will charge these at home. So it's the people that have garages, single-family homes, they'll be able to install places to charge these without a problem. But there's actually a large number of people who live in apartments, condominiums, or even houses that don't have garages, and they will need a place to charge the vehicles also. So what I'm proposing is that, say, future developments of apartments and condominiums be required to install a certain percentage of spaces that can charge the vehicles, or at least the infrastructure to install the charging infrastructure in the future.
Well, you're really proposing more than that, aren't you? I mean, you're saying something like even when people go to work or when they go to restaurants or go out to the shopping center, that there needs to be charging stations. Is that what you're proposing?
Right, and actually we can break down the charging parking use based on how long people would park. So, for example, overnight parking where you have people living or at hotels, you would need more spaces, but where people work and they're only going to park for 8 hours during the day, a less percentage of the people would actually need to charge when they park there. And then there would be some need for parking at shopping centers to alleviate this need for the range anxiety or to get over the range anxiety. So some people would want to be able to charge at the while they go shopping so they don't get stuck if they have that pure electric vehicle.
So what you're saying is that pure electric vehicles are never going to become popular until we can have a wider range of where they can be charged. But do you really foresee that there will be all electric vehicles, none with gasoline like the Chevy Volt? Is that really our future?
I don't think that's entirely the future, but there is Nissan is producing. What I mean by all electric is that there will be some vehicles that only run on electricity. I'm not saying all of the vehicles will be like this.
Okay.
But to get over the early adopters, the people who will buy these initially will be the people who are really interested in these vehicles. But to really mainstream this, yeah, I think we will need some public charging stations, places where the general public will be able to charge the vehicle.
Have you given any consideration to the other problems that go along, though, with electric vehicles? If we're talking about really pervasive, I mean, a lot of electric vehicles, what about the disposable of the battery problem? I mean, we have batteries right now still aren't any good. I mean, isn't there a big problem there to overcome, or have you given any thought to that?
Well, yeah, actually, there are various problems to overcome, and I'm really just focusing on the need for charging infrastructure and... This is actually a report by this Electrification Coalition that addresses not only the environmental impacts and where the batteries come from and disposal, but some of the policy issues I'm talking about. So they talk more about, say, tax credits on the policy side. I'm more talking about, on the local level, what the towns and cities can require in terms of new developments.
So you're proposing mandatory laws that make it mandatory that the shopping centers and restaurants and other public places allow for charging. Would this be a pay per use type of thing that you have in mind? And how do you plan to go about all this?
Great question, actually. And this is one of the outstanding questions. So the reason I wrote this paper for this conference is there are questions like this that are still outstanding that we don't have answers to, and even the technical questions we don't have answers to. So one of the big ones is, who's going to pay for the electricity? Who's going to pay to install these things? And, you know, there are some people who say, well, this is a little bit too overburdening on a business who wants to develop. I think the perception is that we'll have charging stations that work somewhat like parking meters, where you'll pull up and plug in and pay for a certain amount of electricity, either through cash or credit or some sort of device that charges your account, and then you will pay for your own electricity as you charge.
Well, I get asked all the time about solar and why the decks of automobiles, the roofs and that sort of thing, and they sit out in the sun all the time. And then there's these parking garages with these vast, vast areas that there could be solar collectors. And I don't know if this is really a realm that you've gotten into and given any thought to, because I know you're mainly thinking here about these charging stations. But what's the possibility of that? Give us any insight there?
Well, good question also. I think in general, the amount of electricity you can get from solar isn't enough to provide the full amount of power for a vehicle. So they do have these solar challenge vehicles that run on solar electricity only, and those things end up being looking like these moon vehicles or something that's very lightweight and impractical. So you can use solar on, say, the top of a garage to supplement the electricity, but you'll never, at least with the technology at this point, we'll never be able to get enough electricity to fully charge a vehicle just in the sun.
All right, so you're bringing up this problem that we have then if we get to go to all these all-electric cars, but are you offering a solution? I mean, are you calling for mandatory laws that there be this this chicken or the egg problem solved, and that that these charging stations be put in to encourage then the buying of electric cars? And where would you do this, on the local level? I mean, cities and towns, or is this going to be some sort of a national mandate from the Department of Energy and that sort of thing?
Again, great questions. Yeah, what I'm proposing actually is on the local level that they would require some of this infrastructure depending on what is being built. So if you're building a hotel or a condo, you would need more of them. If you're building a shopping center, you would need less of them. But it's really a tricky situation. And the reason I wrote the paper was to ask the questions of the community, and hopefully the people at the conference will look at this and say, yeah, there's actually a desire to require this infrastructure, but we don't have all the answers. So the local cities and towns maybe don't have control over building codes and maybe are actually unable to require them in single-family houses. So it would actually have to be a multi-tiered or multi-level policy approach from the federal government, the state government, and the town governments.
Yeah, I can see that. You're posing the question, but not really the solution. And I can see that if I have an all-electric vehicle and I want to travel, let's say, over to another community or across the state line or something like that, I'm going to want to be able to know that I can charge that vehicle up no matter where I happen to go. And incidentally, I mean, all the hotels and motel rooms already have electrical outlets. So, I mean, you could really park outside of your Hotel 6 and run an extension cord out there and I don't know that there would be much that they could do about that. But a big hotel, when you're up on the third floor, that would be pretty impossible. Do you have any insight there?
Right. Yeah, they might not like it if you have an extension cord running out the window to your vehicle. Mm. So I think the issue is if we can require some of these, then we'll be able to solve that problem. And what I'm actually proposing is something that I proposed in my town here, where we would have this different levels of requirements, and the idea was more to actually get the discussion started and to pull these questions out in the open than to actually pass it at the time. But so my solution or my proposal is that we take what I started proposing, see what the rest of the experts say, and then come up with hopefully a concise document, you know, something that is several pages that really puts in one place the policy needs, the technical needs, and what the towns can actually enact in order to solve the problem.
Okay.
What we ask from the community is to, you know, tell us in a 4 or 5 page document how we can solve this problem, rather than having to go out and look up the technical information, look up other information, and have it all scattered around in different places.
It just seems like it's going to be cumbersome going to the communities. I mean, it's almost like something that you're going to have to take to the Department of Energy. I mean, at one time or other, of course, with gasoline engines, when they were first proposed and then developed, there had to be filling stations across the country. There had to be roads to carry the cars. And it just seems to this reporter that it's going to have to be a national effort, and you're not going to get by with a quilt patchwork program of where you can charge and where you can't. Really? How do you feel about that?
Well, that's completely valid, actually. So the problem is that certain levels of government have control over these different laws, and there are certain things that the federal and state governments can't do that the town governments can do, and then the other way around. So we have to find the right combination of policies, and it would actually be better, you're right, if we can have a uniform policy at higher levels. We do have things like how many handicap parking spaces are required, and we could have a similar policy with the charging stations.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit about some of the other work that you're doing there at Boston University. I understand you're working on interface based on head and eye gestures or motions, and that's for handicapped accessibility. Can you explain that for us?
Yes, so I'm in the computer science department, and what I work on is what we call video-based human-computer interfaces. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that we have a camera that looks back at the user sitting in front of the computer,
okay,
and as they move their heads, say, left and right, then the mouse cursor on the screen...
Oh, there goes Cody again.
Hang on 1 second.
Dear old Cody.
So the idea is that as the person sitting in front of the computer moves their head left or right, mm-hmm, then the mouse cursor on the screen will move left or right in the same kind of manner. And so doing this, we can have the person that otherwise is unable to use the computer control the cursor and use it for different applications, whether they're games or using the web or communication.
You're talking about somebody who's maybe handicapped with their arms and can't use the cursor. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's correct. So instead of being able to type on the keyboard or use the mouse, they can't use their hands at all, but they maybe can still move their neck around, and so they'll use their head to control the mouse pointer on the screen.
That's pretty fascinating. I mean, people that are paraplegic would do a lot there. That would be really terrific. The question that you posed on the electric vehicles, it is kind of a conundrum, and I can see where we're going to have to face up to some of these things as time goes by. So thank you immensely for being with us.
Well, thank you for having me on.
You take good care of Cody there, because I know Cody needs lots of attention. And the next time that we speak on the phone, you might throw Cody a bone.
I'll try to take care of that.
All righty. Goodbye. Thanks, John. So John McGee will be making his case at the IEEE Energy Conference the end of September, and you can see a link to that conference on the right side of your screen at our website. One of the subjects of that conference, of course, is going to be the smart grid, and Lee Goldberg gave us an explanation.
Mostly what we're focusing on is the role of electronics in the power infrastructure. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be looking at everything from how electronics can improve the efficiency and reliability of solar panels, to the role that wireless control systems and smart building systems are going to be playing in helping build an interactive smart grid.
Uh-huh.
I suspect your listeners are probably as familiar with smart grids as I am, but I can give you a quick summary if you like.
Yeah, please do, because they like as many explanations as possible.
Okay. Yeah. Well, basically, the idea of a smart grid is overhauling the 100-year-old infrastructure we have right now, which looks more like a water department, where you fill up the tank on one end and ship it off. You have very little control over what's consumed at any given point, and at the end of the month you kind of look at how much was consumed and send out bills. What they're talking about is transforming the national power grid into something much more like the internet. This is important for a number of reasons. Basically, when you're moving away from, first of all, even if you don't talk about putting solar panels on people's roofs or solar energy, it allows a power company to efficiently use its generating resources, which can lower emissions up to 20% simply by not having to engage to spool up peaking units. Well, let's start back. Let's say you've got an office building, and it's a hot day out. All of a sudden, everybody turns on the air conditioner.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that a smart building can do is only cool the parts of the building that need cooling because there are actually people there, or that you know people are going to be there within the next half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
It will also turn off lights and everything else. Now, when it gets down to the fact that that's not enough, the power company can signal the buildings in the area that it's going to be having to raise, that the buildings need to shed loads, and they'll cooperatively turn off different parts of their non-essential parts of their systems for periods of time to keep the power company from having to either buy electricity on the spot market or generate power by firing up inefficient gas turbines that they only use a few days a year. When it gets down further, once you've got the intelligence in there so that that houses and office buildings and industries are all interacting, so that the power company is broadcasting the availability of power based on price, you can encourage people or companies to use electricity when it's abundant by doing things like charging up their plug-in hybrid vehicles, heating water, pre-chilling buildings, or firing up energy-intensive industrial processes when, let's say, at night, when the wind happens to be blowing very strongly in Texas, and all of a sudden there's an abundance of power, you get to use it instead of letting it kind of just blow past the generator because nobody wants it. The other thing a smart grid allows you to do, besides managing loads, is it allows distributed energy generation, whether it's a local fuel cell generating in a building, generating power or a solar panel on top of the roof. If you've got a large enough, if you have a large enough solar panel that you're actually going to put out a meaningful amount of electricity back onto the grid, you've got to be able to negotiate with the power company and not just toss it on there for them to deal with. So your solar panel wakes up, it finds out it has excess capacity, it advertises it to the grid, and then the grid comes back and says, okay, we can take this much of it, and it gets gated onto the grid, and you get paid for it. Likewise with larger solar farms in the 2-megawatt region, because these things tend to be variable, you know, by time of day and everything else. Without some kind of intelligence added to the grid, wind power and solar power coming on, and large amounts of wind and solar power coming on and off in an unregulated manner could destabilize the grid and will not make it practical. So we have to, in order to have renewable energy be practical, we have to add intelligence to the grid, probably within 15 or 20 years. We'll see the communication going on the power grid. It'll look, our grid will look much more like the internet than it will kind of the 100-year-old infrastructure that we do now. It'll be two-way communication, and power will be coming from all kinds of places.
Well, these are fascinating systems and everything like that, but aren't they going to be coming all passé and obsolete and certainly out of vogue when we finally have a really cheap or totally no-cost energy source that the future is going to deliver to us?
Well, you tell me. Well, even if there's no, I can't imagine a day that energy isn't going to cost something. Safe nuclear from even MOX technologies were the new micro generators that Bill Gates has been touting recently are going to cost significant money. So I think that basically what we're doing is building an infrastructure that can adapt to using these new energy sources. Whether solar and wind become passé and we do go all nuclear or whatever else, it's going to require an intelligent grid. I don't think that we can do business as usual regardless of what the energy source is. So what we're doing now, it's a lot like one of the clever things about hybrid cars is the fact that even though batteries are too expensive and too bulky right now to provide all the power, they provide a way of retooling cars right now so that they're dual fuel system, and they can be adapted to whatever comes out, whether it's batteries or fuel cells or whatever else. The remaining infrastructure of the hybrid, all that technology gets preserved, and so smart grid technologies, the things we're going to be talking about there, will serve as a matrix that allows whatever advanced energy technologies we come up with in terms of generation to be plugged in seamlessly and smoothly into the grid. How electronics plays a role in the generation of renewable electric power, mm-hmm. some of the interesting smart building technologies that we use to manage energy, and we'll also be looking at energy conservation, whether it's in ultra efficient electric motor drives, because until recently, for instance, electric motors, well, variable speed electric motors generally basically were like, if you want to slow down the motor, it was like putting the brake on while you were running full throttle. Mm-hmm. You burned a lot of energy. Now, with advanced electronics that shape the waveforms going into motors, you're only putting as much energy as you need into the motor. Or another great energy conservation technology is solid-state lighting. But solid-state lighting with LEDs, the LEDs are maturing, but we also have to mature the electronics that drive them.
Thank you, Lee Goldberg. Great to have you back. And next half hour, a report from Australia. And where are all the jobs? Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Jeffrey Timmons here. Always do what you say you're going to do. It's the glue and fiber that binds successful relationships.